Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard. I'm very happy because I have filmmaker Brierly Long with me. Hey, Brierly.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here on Zoom. We were almost going to be in person, but we switched to Zoom. And I never mind that change. But let me give everyone a warning off the bat. We're not responsible for the audio quality. I know Zoom compresses us. Plus, there's a micro delay when you talk on Zoom. So I swear to you, Brierly and I will never interrupt each other. But then when you listen back to a Zoom recording, that micro delay, sometimes people speak just a little bit above each other. But I swear, we're going to be really polite. So anyway, let me introduce Brierly properly, which is you directed and you were also one of the producers of the film Homologies. And Homologies was at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, what feels like just a couple months ago, but I think it was probably four or five at this point, November of 2023. Homologies was at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival and took home the Programmer's Prize for Exceptional Filmmaking and the Audience Award for Best Short Film Drama. I'm giving a golf clap on Zoom for Brierly to see because I really appreciate Homologies, and I think it's just such a smart, well-made film. Just really my kind of sci-fi, as I like to say. It's thinky, smart sci-fi with no special effects, which I know you probably didn't set out to specifically do that kind of genre, but it certainly fits, I think.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. It was really great to play at Sherman Oaks Film Festival, and it was exciting too. So this is my second short as a director to be playing in festivals, and it was my first award. So, you know, you're always going to have a very special place in my heart because your festival gave me my first award as a filmmaker. So thank you very much.
And it was that feels so good. I'm actually quite proud of. I think our juries. I might be biased, but I think our juries have really good taste and we just care about quality. And like, actually, like I said, Homologies got the Audience Award for Best Short Film Drama. And here I am calling it sci-fi. Like, I bet it could have been in multiple categories, maybe even art house. But I'm a fan of art house. So I feel everything I like feels artsy enough to me to play at an art house theater. But let me just jump right in and ask you, I mean, this podcast is about getting to know you as a creative and as a filmmaker, because as I told you before we started recording, I just think the people who make independent films are doing a service for humankind. We used to hang around a campfire and share stories, and now we're isolated at home with little screens in our hands, occasionally a bigger screen in front of us, and we share not enough communication. So I really think that the indie filmmaker is filling in that gap of the storyteller that we don't get enough of from corporate capitalist media, that instead of telling us stories, they've got they have a job to do, which is to scare the fuck out of us. By the way, we're allowed to curse. There's an explicit warning on this podcast. I always try to curse first, although you don't strike me as a big
absolutely not
cursor. All right, I'll try to control it. But you want to share when you first got interested in the creative arts?
Yeah, so it's interesting that you mentioned the sort of history of storytelling, because I actually got my start in theater, and I was an actress before becoming a filmmaker. And I also did a lot of dance growing up and choreography, and so I've been both in the sort of live performance space and then, you know, now the on camera space, and they are quite different, but also like clearly there's a tradition there, and it's nice to sort of, you know, be keeping that tradition alive, I guess. You know, hopefully we're not going to get replaced by AI too quickly. So I started my career as an actress in Japan, and I was working with a theater company that does sort of very, they call it contemporary colloquial theater. So it's based on the way that people actually interact in everyday life, rather than kind of this very elevated, you know, forward, you know, Shakespeare, kind of very, you know, performative way of acting that might be more typical of what you see, say, in on Broadway, or, you know, I'd say kind of more the Western theater tradition. And so the theater company that I worked with, it was kind of more like the audience is like peeking into a situation and there's multiple conversations happening at once. And it's, sometimes people are not, you know, a lot of like what we see in film and television, people might not be talking about like the big topics that are important to them. They'll be talking about like tea or food, and it's like all about the subtext and then how the subtext filters through in these these minute interactions. I think it's actually a form of theater that kind of lends itself very well to film. And so there's actually a Cannes award-winning film director who became a member of our theater company. And, funnily enough, that was the very first project that I got cast in upon joining the theater company was a feature film. And so this director, Koji Fukada, he really liked working with the actors from our company because of sort of the naturalist style that we had of working, which translates well to on-camera work, you know, where you don't want to be expounding too much. You kind of want it to seem like it's a moment in life. And so I, you know, having grown up like very much like, you know, into theater and, you know, going to see concerts and like, you know, classical music concerts or like ballet or things like that. I actually grew up in a household with no television. So I was not so well versed in film and television. And then my first sort of intimate experience was being on set on a feature film. And I just immediately fell in love with it. And I thought, oh, this is what I want to do. I ended up working with the director Fukada on various projects, as an actress, but also, we collaborated on a theater production that I directed where he filmed videos that were sort of projected behind on the back of the stage. And then, he saw me. So the next project I got cast in was, I was acting opposite a real android robot. And it was kind of like, I was the first actor in the world to work on stage with a real android robot. And we toured that play all over the world and Fukada saw it. And right away he thought, I want to make this into a feature film. And so that was interesting because the first feature I'd done, like I had just been brought on as an actress, you know, as in the typical manner you audition and then you get the role and then you're on set, and, you know, and you maybe have a bit of rehearsals. And then suddenly there's a film festival and you're like, yay, we're promoting the film. But the second time was a very different experience because, you know, he came to me very, very early on in the script development. He said, I want to make this feature film and I want you to star in it. Are you interested? And I was like, yes, absolutely. And then, in the process of fundraising and stuff, he was just like, can you help me with translating the crowdfunding page into English? And then I kind of took on I was like, you know what, actually I'm really interested in learning how to make a movie. So, do you want me to come on board and help you produce it? And so that was an amazing experience because I got to then, you know, live through the whole life of that feature film with the director from, you know, fundraising, script development, bringing on, you know, a distributor, bringing on different producers and getting the whole creative team. Like I was really proud that I got to recommend the cinematographer who he ended up working with on a number of projects. And it was a beautiful collaboration. And so sort of to be involved in all those other elements that actors don't usually get to touch upon. And then also the whole very lengthy process of post-production and, you know, submitting to festivals and distribution and like how you have to promote a film. So it was, you know, a multi-year process. And I really loved that whole experience of being much more creatively involved in making a movie than as an actress where, you know, you have a few days on set and then, you know, you're not really part of the movie until it's out in the film festivals, you know? Well, I say a few days because in Japan, we shoot features in very short time spans, you know, it's like 10 days for a feature film. So, So then that film, you know, it opened in competition at Tokyo International Film Festival, and at Rotterdam Film Festival, and it was released theatrically in France and Japan. And, you know, it was kind of like a really big deal to be, you know, on the red carpet, getting lots of press. And, you know, I was part of the main press conference for the Tokyo International Film Festival. And it was really exciting because there hadn't been like a foreign actress starring in a Japanese film. It was very unique. And so, you know, I really expected that this would kind of lead to like just my career as an actress just taking off. And a lot of people came up to me and they're like, wow, that was incredible. We'll call you when we have a role for a foreigner. And then I discovered, well, okay, that's actually quite limited in the Japanese film industry. And interestingly, like one of my best friends from the theater company, she had also just starred in a film by Kim Ki-duk, who's also an award-winning filmmaker. And she also kind of, you know, both of us expected, oh, this is gonna, like, we just starred in these feature films and major film festivals. This is gonna just open up our careers. And then the reality of, you know, I think what I've learned now is that it's not one project that like will, you know, just make or break your career. Usually it's, you have to create that continuity. And then there's, you know, specific circumstances, like, you know, being a white woman in Japan, where you're like, you're very select niche. And so both of us kind of had this frustration where we're like, you know, why aren't we getting the roles that we want to play? You know, why are we kind of waiting around for someone to call us to have a project for us? Like, why don't we just create something ourselves? And so that was my first inspiration for directing. Is, you know, this friend and I, we were having drinks one night and we were like, let's just write a script and make a movie. And then, you know, if we start doing this, we're going to be able to create our own stories and, you know, play different roles than whatever we get cast in, you know? So that was a really beautiful experience I had. So this one actress like co-wrote the script with me, and then another actress friend helped me produce it. So there was a number of actors who were involved in bringing this project together. And it really felt like a kind of little family, you know, like everyone was so sad when the project was done. They're like, oh, like, but can't we keep hanging out? Like, you know, because it was a passion project. You know, we made that film for like less than $300. But it doesn't look like it. It looks pretty amazing because we had amazing locations that were provided for free. You know, everyone was volunteering their time. We got free equipment, and it was, you know, it was a really beautiful process. And now that I'm not advocating, you know, doing things for free. Like, I think it's fine when you're beginning, you know. But so that was my first experience in directing, and that film played in, you know, I didn't have a distributor or publicist or anything. I was doing it on my own. But it did play in a couple festivals, which was really exciting. Played at New Filmmakers Los Angeles and New Filmmakers New York. And so it was, you know, having not gone to film school or, you know, just like making a film myself, it was exciting to see it play opposite. Like we at New Filmmakers LA, we were in the same block of shorts as like an Oscar nominated short film, one of my favorite Oscar nominated short films, actually, Nefta Football Club. So I was like, wow, it's amazing we can be here. And so I started with, you know, just wanting to make films on my own, and I had written a feature script in Japan as well. But then when I kind of like got to taking the feature to producers, you know, I would get feedback of like, okay, this is, you know, you need to improve this script. And I was like, okay, I understand what you're saying, but I don't know how to do it. And then a very happy accident happened with, like, during the pandemic, UCLA reached out to me. They needed a teaching assistant for their screenwriting program. And I had been very involved in the sort of UCLA community, as having been there as an actress. And they said, you know, you'll get to study screenwriting if you can take on this job. And I was like, oh, perfect, because I've wanted to learn structure and to understand more about, like, you know, what makes a good feature film script. So then during the pandemic, I got to write a couple more feature scripts and learn much more about, like, sort of how to tell a story and through writing. But then my acting manager actually said, you know, it's great that you've learned writing, but, you know, like, you actually understand writing more when you also study directing. You know, you have to, because screenwriting is such a specific art. And so then that my acting managers like encouraged me to pursue my studies of directing. And I went and did a master's in Spain, which is where I filmed Homologies. And I had the opportunity to direct three short films over the course of 9 months. And it was really an amazing experience. And it's up until, I guess, I would say up until the pandemic, I was still primarily an actress, and wanting to, you know, make some projects, but with myself in them. And when I did my master's, I thought, actually, I really want to just focus on directing. I don't want to be acting in my own projects, you know, because I want to learn the art of communicating to other actors. And, you know, same actually with like with Homologies, I worked with a screenwriter, I worked with an editor, you know, how you, they often say that the film is written in three parts. There's a script, and then there's the directing, and then there's the edit. And I thought, I really want to focus on the job of directing. So I'm going to have actors, I'm going to have a screenwriter, I'm going to have an editor, I'm going to work with these different departments, and how do I communicate with them instead of sort of the more indie style of let me do it all myself. And so through that process of directing multiple short films, I think that I really grew a lot as a director, and I thought, wow, this is really something where my experience as an actress and then experience as a writer, like all of these things come together, in a very fulfilling and creative way. I think I've always been kind of a creative person and not someone just waiting for opportunities to come my way. I like to create opportunities for other people and get them on board my team. And so I think like right now my focus has shifted very much to directing. So
I have like 100 questions. questions for you. Although I guess I should only ask the important ones, but boy, well, first I love that. There's a term I've always loved, which is a global citizen. Like, you strike me as a global citizen considering you've spent extensive time in Japan and then also went to Spain for a graduate film degree. So that's really fascinating. But I'm going to jump all the way back to the dance for a moment, because I actually happen to be super, super interested in the connection between dance and actually filmmaking, because I have met through this podcast quite a few people who started quite seriously as in dance as performers. And then, you know, dance is incredibly hard on the body and maybe the soul too. And one of my jokes with everyone who grew up in ballet academies and then went on to film, I'm like, oh, so film wasn't competitive at all for you, was it? And they always laugh like you just did, because dance prepares you for everything, doesn't it? So what was your, am I making too much of the dance connection, or as a kid, were you really, were you full on dance academy kind of kid?
Well, so, okay. Multi-part answer to your question. So, it does actually tie into the global citizen thing, because, I grew up in Vietnam, Bosnia, France, England, Switzerland.
I was supposed to ask you where you grew up.
Yeah. So I grew up in many different countries. And, when I was a little kid, you know, I told my parents, I want to be an actress, but we were living in Vietnam, and, they didn't know where to find acting classes for me in Vietnam. So they're like, well, how about dance? And I was part of the Vietnamese National Children's Dance Troupe. I performed in like the 70th anniversary of communism in Vietnam as like a little patriot, you know, wearing the kind of like red scarf and, you know, holding banners of like Ho Chi Minh and stuff. And I got to learn ballet and jazz dance and Vietnamese dance, traditional dance. And, I did grow up, I would say, not like, you know, in dance camp, because I wasn't in the US. I grew up, you know, first in this Vietnamese dance training. And then after that, we moved to Bosnia and I was at the Sarajevo Opera Ballet. And it was
I think people would be mad at me if I didn't ask what your parents were up to, that you were traveling like that or living in these places.
So they do humanitarian aid work. My mom works in like refugee issues and also, with like counter trafficking right now. And she's also worked with, and my dad works in environmental issues. So, you know, humanitarian aid is actually also one of those sectors that it's, or my parents' career is definitely in NGOs and stuff, is surprisingly similar and to independent filmmaking in terms of you have to like raise funds yourself and, you know, convince
and,
people.
And I'm glad that we clearly, I mean, not that there's anything wrong with being a military kid, but it's like being the opposite of a military kid and yet having the same kind of upbringing where you're moving around all the time and always exposed to other cultures, which I think is just an amazing experience.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. Cause it was interesting coming back to the US. So I lived outside of the United States from age 8 to like age 30. And then coming back to the United States, you know, people kind of had a hard time making sense of me, you know, with why do you speak like more than 5 languages? And, you know, and so their immediate answer is like, oh, you're a military brat. And I'm like, no, that's not at all my story. But they kind of, people always want to put you into an easily comprehensible box. And I think that my box is a little bit hard to understand for most people. So thank you for asking about that.
And it's very, I mean, besides thinking everyone who traveled as a kid was involved in the military, I mean, also I don't want to insult my own people, but we North American people in the United States are just so, our country's just so big, we're barely exposed to Canada or Mexico, let alone other cultures. Like, it's just an experience that they, most people just don't get. I was just lucky to travel a lot when I got a little older, but actually have best. A nice thing about living in Los Angeles, if depending on where you are, is it is very multicultural. And I actually had friends who were born in India and born in Korea, and we were best friends growing up. So going to someone's house where no one made hamburgers was like an important part of who I became. But anyway, not about me. So that's fascinating. So what came after Vietnam?
Bosnia. So I was
Bosnia.
At the Sarajevo.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I was at the Sarajevo Opera Ballet School, which is beautiful, and also very haunting in the sense that it was kind of like the first generation of dancers to graduate from that ballet school since the war. And you could see like there was these beautiful windows looking out on the river and the mountains where, you know, during the war snipers would have been shooting into the studio, or they could have. And it was like a very unique historical moment. I actually have a feature project that I want to make at some point about the time in Bosnia. My mom was working in counter trafficking, and we kind of had to, she ended up getting a lot of threats from the mafia, and we had to leave in a very precipitated manner. My sister and I, that's sort of what the story is about, this sort of weird post-war time. And from the perspective of a kid, sort of witnessing that.
I'm going to jump in and ask a really, I hope it's not too inappropriate, but here's your mother with two young women in a former war zone dealing with anti-trafficking, I assume is about the trafficking of young women in general.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
That must have been your mom or both your parents' life story. I mean, that's a movie right there to have a young blonde daughter in Bosnia and you're in the anti-trafficking world. And oh my gosh. Wow. My mind is blown.
Well, I hope I'll get to share that film with you not in the not too distant future. You know, right now it's sort of still script development stage, but I do have a script already, a full feature script about my time in Hanoi, Vietnam in the 1990s as a little blonde kid and what that was like. And
that was pre the melting of the relationship, right? It was still the US-Vietnam relationship didn't really warm.
It was right around that time that it was starting to warm up. So
right, like under Clinton, I think it warmed.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's when we were there, was the Clinton era. So it was interesting because things were just starting to open up, but we were still, you know, spied on all the time. Like there was a microphone in our house and people would follow us everywhere we went. And have you ever seen the movie Goodbye Lenin?
No.
It's about sort of like the post Berlin Wall fall, you know, and that movie it reminded me a lot of my childhood. It's funny, like seeing, oh yeah, all these sort of like Soviet era, like, you know, stuff, and you know, that you have this people watching each other, like reporting on their neighbors to, like, you know, the Ministry of Interior or whatever. You know, literally my mom's faxes would, when she got a bill and the faxes were being forwarded to like the censorship bureau before they would go out to the United States. And they were trying to charge her for that local, you know, fax. And she was like, you're going to spy on me.
We're going to surveil you and bill you for the surveillance.
Exactly.
That sounds like the movie Brazil when they had the, what were they called? It was, you know, I don't know if you saw Brazil, but Brazil was like, information retrieval charges.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. So, I have a movie that I'm trying to get off the ground about the, like, being in Hanoi during the 1990s when things were changing a lot, you know, kind of going from a much more communist society to, you know, free market, and kind of also in a way, like there, I think it was also like an opening up of, like, you know, mores around like sexuality and femininity and, like, you know, kind of pop culture. And, you know, I was like a young girl, like kind of becoming a teenager then, and, you know, sort of like the Spice, that was the era of the Spice Girls and Britney Spears and like all those things kind of like also filtering through to Vietnam and the culture clash. So that's one movie that I'm hoping to make soon. And then I'm also hoping to, you know, I have this other story about the time in Bosnia and the post-war period and the mafia counter-trafficking issues and all that. And both of these kind of like told through the lens of a child. So when I was growing up, so one thing I was doing is obviously lots of dance, but I also kept journals. So those journals have been very, very helpful as now I'm like writing feature scripts as an adult and kind of like thinking back on those times. So it sounds like I'm doing only autobiographical movies. That's not the case, but
I'll defend you. Your story is too freaking interesting to ignore. So yeah, make the fictional narratives and tell the greatest stories you can, but those stories certainly deserve to be told. Wow.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
But here, because I keep pushing you backwards now, I'll push you forwards. What came after Bosnia?
So after Bosnia, so I was in France briefly. My sister and I were in the French countryside. And then after that, my family moved to London. That's where I graduated from the French lycée. And then I went to Geneva to train full time in ballet for a year. And then also part way through that year, I kind of figured that ballet was less my world, and I moved to New York to the Merce Cunningham dance studio. So I trained, in their professional program for a bit. And then,
and I'm just going to jump in and add that, I mean, the level of ballet you're talking about is harder than professional sports. I mean, it is that level of physical demand and lack of free time. I mean, you know what I mean? I just want to commend you for what you went through. I mean, I almost feel like everything I've heard about ballet academies is it's harder than boot camp at the Army.
Yeah. I mean, I think that definitely there's a lot of discipline. So about what you're saying about people coming from the dance world to film, I think that there's a huge discipline that comes with training, be it in sports or in the dance to a high level. You just have to like do it every day, and you're used to working long hours and, you know, putting your body under a certain amount of duress that does come with filmmaking too, unfortunately. And I think the other thing is that I found that also I always had like very good relationships with a lot of my fellow dancers, because you're training so hard that it kind of strips some of that artifice, you know, where you're just like, you want the show to succeed together. So everybody has to put in their best work. There's a level of trust that comes from working physically together on something. So I definitely think that those are some like qualities that translate into working on a film set. The other thing is that, so for me, cause I didn't, you know, grow up going to dance camp and getting all the right perfect training from age three to like become a prima ballerina because of my parents' like sporadic lifestyle moving around. And, you know, so I realized when I was training full-time as a dancer that I wasn't going to be the star dancer. And so that's kind of what shifted me more towards choreography and, you know, wanting to work with other dancers who are better than me, but being able to see the whole, you know, and understand the whole picture and then, you know, have them execute those beautiful movements and try out different things that, and so I think that that's kind of what ultimately put me into directing, because you're essentially, when you're doing choreography, you're telling a story visually. And I think,
yeah, I mean, the choreographer is like the screenwriter, right? I mean, the analogy
screenwriter
to
and
film,
the director.
Yeah. The analogy to filmmaking is direct.
Yep. And I think with filmmaking too, you know, there's a lot of people who just study screenwriting. That's why I'm so glad I got to study not only screenwriting, but also directing, because they are distinct, somewhat distinct arts in the sense that like screenwriting is, you know, it comes with a lot of text, and filmmaking, you know, I love dialogue heavy films. Like I do love dialogue, but also like the origin of film is visual storytelling. And so that's where I think that choreography translates really well to directing, because you know, dialogue can be great, but also you need to just be able to tell a story in its essence through the visuals.
And through movement, right? Through
exactly.
The camera movement is choreography, as well as the blocking of the actors is choreography.
Exactly. And so, you know, even like, you know, working with a cinematographer, it's like composing, it's like choreography, because you're composing within that image. And then also the other thing where it translated really well was in choreography, you know, I got to work with the dancers who are executing the movements. I got to work with, you know, the stage designer, the lighting designer, the composer. And these are all things that when I discovered directing, I was like, oh, wait a minute. All of these things come into directing too. You know, these things I've been thinking about, like costumes, colors, you know, sound, lights, all of these things are what you need to do as a director. So it was like a very natural transition. So I think that like the, having been an actress, but then also having done choreography, was like, oh wait. And then screenwriting, like, is like, where do all of these things come together is film directing. Cause knowing how to speak with composers, you know, like I had an opportunity to choreograph a piece where I was working with a composer. And so he was, I was creating the dance at the same time as he's creating the music that then was performed by an orchestra, and my dance is performed by these dancers. And so now when I'm working with composers on my films, I have that experience already of you know, actually creating the music from scratch and how the pieces come together. And also like on top of that, the privilege of also having danced with an orchestra, with a live orchestra performing too. And so I feel like that gave me a certain understanding of music that then translates as well into the directing. So I think, yeah, they're definitely in terms of telling a story, and for dance people who are maybe not choreographers, but dancers, I think it's the physical storytelling too. Like it definitely helped my acting a lot to have this like very physical way of embodying a character. And I think also that's what an audience relates to, you know, at the end is like, is the person that they're seeing on screen, does this person really feel like they're living that life? And it's not just through what they're saying, but it's what their body's expressing. And that's what we connect to.
Absolutely. All right. So you go to this little town called New York City and dance pulls you there, but that's where you transition from performance more to production and choreography and storytelling.
So what happened is that I was in New York, and then when I was in the ballet school, I had applied to Oxford University, just like in case I didn't want to continue just ballet. I was starting to feel like it wasn't quite my world. And then I got into study Japanese at Oxford, and I was in New York at the Merce Cunningham Studio. And you know, I told my parents.
And Japanese is not one of your languages yet, right?
No, not at that point. So I told my parents, you know, like, actually, I love New York. I love the Merce Cunningham Studio. I'm just going to stay in New York and become a dancer. You know, I was 18 and like, great, I got into Oxford, but I'm not going to go. And my parents said, oh, well, if you want to do that, you're on your own. So you want to be a dancer? It's a very tough job. We're not supporting that financially. If you want to go to Oxford, we'll help you out and you can continue dancing. And so at age 18, I thought about it and I was like, maybe I should go to Oxford.
By the way, I kind of love that your parents did that.
Yeah, I love it too.
Because the Oxford opportunity was probably, what parent can watch their kid turn down Oxford?
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, I'm grateful to my parents for, you know, like, I think always both encouraging me to pursue what I love and working in the arts and so on, and also, you know, not coddling me too much, you know.
Yeah, like, they encouraged you to own it.
Exactly. So when I graduated from Oxford, I went to work with a theater company in Japan, and, you know, the same, like, they weren't like, oh yes, like, acting is very hard, let's just, like, you know, support you financially or whatever. They were like, okay, you have a degree now. You have ways to make money if you need to, you know, you're smart, you'll figure it out, you know, good luck. And so I think that that's been, like, good to sort of really, like, part of my trajectory as an artist is always like, well, you also have to make a living, and how are you going to do that? And I think that, that's, you know, it also has, it's something that's pushed me to succeed because I don't just have the freedom of just making art for art's sake at all times. You know, it's like, you have to have a very strong reason that you want to tell a story, and that you're going to dedicate the time and, you know, make the resources somehow come together to tell that story. And yeah.
Yeah. Fascinating. Okay. So Oxford leads direct, by the way, the decision to study Japanese, was that you were just fascinated with Japan and Japanese culture? What made you decide? Because I find that to be a really interesting choice for, I mean, look, thankfully my nephew doesn't listen to this, but like, I had nieces and a nephew who spent 4 years of their youth in Germany. And then they chose to, like, minor in German in college. And I'm like, okay, you're kind of cheating. So you had all these languages, and then you chose a completely new language for your area of study.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the reasons was that Japanese is supposedly, like, alongside potentially Arabic, like, the hardest language in the world to learn. So I was like, great, I want to learn the hardest language because I already speak a bunch of other languages. So might as well go for the most difficult option. That was part of it. And then the other part of it is that, my dad collects Japanese prints, and my grandfather was in Japan sort of at the end of the Second World War. And so there's this kind of, like, intergenerational interest in Japan. I think that I was kind of exposed to elements of Japanese culture through their stories, through my dad's print collection. And then ultimately just simply because when I was at ballet school, there was a Japanese dancer who didn't, this was in Geneva, so French speaking. And there was this Japanese dancer who came to train at the ballet school, and she didn't speak a word of either French or English. And she was, like, very alone. And I kind of, like, reached out to her, and I was like, and I wanted to become friends with her. And then I thought, well, if she's working so hard to learn English, I should try learning Japanese. And so I had kind of just, like, while at ballet school, I bought myself a book to, like, learn the basics of Japanese. And I was kind of already starting to go down that rabbit hole. So I think it's just, like, sort of the encounters that life throws at you, right? That, bring you on that path.
So after Oxford, you go straight to Tokyo because that's the most logical thing to do.
Yeah. So I had done my dissertation on contemporary Japanese theater at Oxford. And I went to Tokyo I got a grant from Oxford to go, like, spend a summer in Tokyo between my third and fourth year, just, like, seeing lots of theater, interviewing directors and so on. And then one of the directors that I met with sort of in my final year, you know, I wrote them a thank you. I was like in the midst of writing up my dissertation. I was like, happy new year. You know, it was wonderful meeting with you. And, you know, I hope we'll have the opportunity to like maybe work together in the future. And then he wrote back, oh, actually, we're recruiting like a new generation of actors. Are you interested in joining our company? And so basically in my, over Christmas holidays of my final year, I got a job offer to go be an actress in Japan. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. Yeah, I'll go do that. So I got, they sponsored me for my visa and I moved to Tokyo. And I think like at the time, both them and myself thought, oh, this will be like kind of 1 or 2 year experience. And then I'll come back to, you know, the UK or the US and pursue acting in English. But that 1 or 2 year experience like turned into 8 years. So.
Wow. So your first 8 years out of university.
Yep. Where I was.
And you're educated enough. So you're living and are you only using English when you're on the phone with your parents? you're completely immersed in you're acting in Japanese and living in Japan. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because like I was in a Japanese theater company, you know, I was the only non-Japanese, or I mean, there was like a Korean member of the company, Japanese Korean member of the company too. But other than that, I was like the only foreigner to be part of the company. So it was really nice because I was just like very much just immersed into the culture, very deep. It wasn't until like maybe my second year in Japan that I like even really got to know any other foreigners, because just all of my colleagues were Japanese. I did end up making some nice friends who are foreigners or part Japanese and, you know, as well, but definitely my whole sort of professional environment and a lot of my like also social environment being in the arts was entirely Japanese, because there at this point there weren't many foreigners in that, you know, there are a few, but it's definitely like a handful rather than, you know, a lot of so it's been interesting actually, because since I left Japan, I moved to LA in 2018, and then from 2018 to 2020, I was still going back and forth quite a bit, and I was acting a lot in Japan and basically paying for my life in LA through acting in Japan. But then like 2020, things shut down. In 2021, I was like offered 3 starring roles in feature films that I wasn't able to take because the borders were closed. So I kind of like was forcibly like had some distance away from Japan, but then strangely enough, like, you know, in the interim, there's now like all these kind of more and more international shows that are like, I don't know if you've seen Tokyo Vice, Shogun, like there's these, you must have seen the billboards for Shogun, they're all around, but there's kind of like this new, I think, attraction to Japan, that's happened over the past, because the Tokyo Olympics was meant to take place in 2020, it got pushed, but I left living there full time in 2018. And I feel like from 2018 to today, like first with the whole sort of hype around the Olympics, and it's become a much more, it's drawn many more. And now that things have opened up again post pandemic, and the value of the Japanese yen fell. So like suddenly it was more affordable for Americans to go there. It's strange to go back and see how much it's opened up to the world, compared to like when I first moved there in 2010, when I was there, there weren't really like American shows that casting in Japan. And now like, you know, there's a boom in like sort of Japan Hollywood production. So, which is really exciting too.
I bet. I'm going to admit it's a silly question, but when you're living in Japan and thinking about your life story and being surrounded by, when you were saying you were surrounded by mostly Japanese people and this and that, like, so when an American often is in a foreign, is, you know, we often crave like a little time with a fellow American. But I imagine for you, when you were around a fellow American, you're like, I've spent time in Vietnam and Bosnia and London, and like you don't feel like home at all. Was that true, or was there a bit of a comfort when you'd bump into an American?
I have to say, I didn't have like a ton of American friends in Japan. I think it's like the friends I have in Japan, the international friends I have in Japan, like, you know, a bunch of them are married to Japanese people, or like they're also part Japanese. And like, so I think their sort of cultural experience goes quite deep. I think it's kind of like, yeah, if you're coming from one culture and you have very specific points of reference, and then you come to this other culture and it doesn't fit those points of reference, then that's one sort of form of culture shock, where I was like, okay, but the points of reference that you have from the United States seem just as strange to me. Like, I don't see, I guess the sort of, it's just different points of reference.
Well, and you didn't grow up glued to a TV watching Saturday morning cartoons either.
I
distracted you with my, obviously I'm fascinated with travel and living overseas. So anyway, and even overseas is a biased term, right? As if, anyway, so COVID really had a huge impact on you, changing your trajectory. And then it was after COVID is when you decided to do the film school in Spain.
Yeah, well, it depends on when you define after COVID.
Oh, that's true. After lockdown, I should say.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So during lockdowns, I was in LA. No, I was in Japan when COVID started. I was performing on stage in Japan in this production with like actors from, I think, six different countries who had all come together to do this like multilingual production. And then, like, you know, it was funny because like things were starting to shut down, but we were able to finish our run in the theater. And then it was like, okay, get home to your countries quickly. And then that's really when everything like shut down. And we were supposed to be like doing another European tour of that production, which didn't happen because of COVID. But I got back to LA I hadn't been living in LA that long. I didn't really like, you know, my parents, my sister are in Europe. And so I thought like, I don't want to get stuck in Los Angeles. Like, it's very expensive. I don't want to be in an apartment here. Just like, you know, when nothing's happening, it felt very isolating. And so I went first down to Baja to stay with my aunt and uncle, in Mexico for the first couple months, thinking it was just going to be like a little wait it out and we'll come back. And then it ended up like being longer. So I went back to France to my parents' home in the countryside. And then that's when I got offered the UCLA screenwriting, teaching assistant gig. So I did that from France.
Oh, that was all remote.
It was all remote. Exactly. Yeah. So I was in the French countryside doing that, and then sort of partway through my time in France, I felt again like very isolated in the countryside. You know, I mean, everyone felt isolated during COVID, but you know, I was lucky to at least have a job and be learning, and you know, and then I signed with an agent in Spain, and I thought, oh, I've never been to Spain, and like after my short stint in Mexico, I really want, and after having been in LA, I was like, I really need to learn Spanish, you know, like. If I want to come back to LA, I feel stupid saying like, oh, I speak all these languages, but I haven't bothered to learn Spanish. So I was like, well, maybe I should go to Spain for a bit and meet this agent and, you know, actually learn Spanish. And so I went to Madrid for like just a short stint. And then I loved it. And I thought, oh, like maybe I'll just stay in Spain and work as an actress in Spain. And, but I needed to get a visa for that. And so I thought, well, why don't I apply for like a directing master's that would allow me to live and work in Spain? So that was again, like part of the motivation. So And then,
right, because an educational visa is a lot easier to get.
Exactly.
Or it's a better path than saying, I want to live here for a while.
Yeah, exactly. So, so I got into like the top film school in Spain in Barcelona. And so I moved there. It was 2022. So it was when I moved, the course started in January of 2022. When we started the course, people were still like masked in all of our classes. Like by the end of the year in Spain, at the very least, it was like, oh yeah, even if you test positive, you can come on set, just wear a mask. You know, it was an evolution, but so yeah, it was also like when I applied for the master's and stuff, it was also in this kind of weird, and when I was like thinking of going to Spain, was in this weird time when I was like getting all these great offers from Japan. And then like, you know, the frustration of like, oh, I could be starring in a feature film in Japan, but there's like these lockdown restrictions. So it's, you know, turning, what do you say, like making lemonade out of lemons or whatever, like, you know, turning like a missed opportunity into something good, you know, like,
yeah,
well,
yeah, because like Japan was so strict, like you couldn't even just go there and isolate in a hotel for 3 weeks or something, like it was very strict.
Yeah, for artist visas in particular. I think that maybe it was funny because like one of the productions was actually like, it was financed by the city of Osaka, and even like the city of Osaka appealed to the like immigration bureau on my behalf, and they said, no, sorry, we're not issuing any entertainer visas right now. Like, and I think that maybe some of the like bigger American productions might've managed to skirt around that. But, which is ironic that like the Japanese local productions were not able to like convince immigration to let me in. But yeah, it was definitely like a weird time.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So, it doesn't sound bad to live in the French countryside and work remotely, for UCLA. But somewhere along the line, you must've met Tatiana Blackington James, who I probably should have mentioned in the intro was, you know, you're the screenwriter and producing partner on Homologies. My understanding is she brought Homologies to you.
What happened is Tatiana and I were both part of this writers group called Safe House that I performed in as an actress in LA. So I think I joined Safe House in 2018 or 2019. And then when Safe House, when COVID started, we moved Safe House to online. So that was also like, whether I was in Mexico or France or, you know, Spain, or like I was continuing to log into Safe House online. And it's quite funny actually, because like Safe House usually would take place at like 7 p.m. LA time, which would be 4 a.m. for me in Europe. But I still logged in because I was like, I want to be part of that community and read scripts and act. Like, I don't care if I have to get up at 3:30 a.m. and have a coffee and be online at 4 a.m. I was like, I'll do that. So so I was like very much involved in that sort of Safe House community all through the pandemic. And Tatiana would present scripts at Safe House. So I read various scripts for her. And then Homologies, she presented that script end of 2021. So like literally like it was the last Safe House I took part in LA, like before moving to Spain for my master's. And she had me reading the role of the mother. And I thought like, wow, this is a really great script. And I don't think I would play the mother, like but it got me thinking because I kind of like, she had written the script, I think, from the perspective of the parents, but then I kind of related to the script more from the perspective of the children. And, but then being put in the position of like reading the mother's story, like it made me think like, huh, this helps me to understand like maybe the tensions I had with my own parents growing up. And, you know, I thought that's really interesting when a script like helps you think about the perspective of your other family members, you know? And so I was, you know, I told Tatiana how much I liked her script. And then it was very quickly in my mind, like when I went to Spain, like, maybe I have to direct three films. Maybe this should be one of those films. And then I pitched her an idea very early on about, like, because the whole script, like, the only challenge with the script is that it read almost like a play, and that it, like, all takes place in one room. And so the challenge was, like, how are we going to make this into a film, you know, that works visually as well? And so first of all, I pitched her an idea with, like, you know, trying to add in all these, like, other scenes and, like, cut tos and, you know, and then, and she was like, yeah, no, like, she kind of, I think she continued to interview a few, I think she was looking for a director. So she continued to interview a few other directors. In the meantime, I made my first film in Spain, where, like, it was within less than 2 months of, like, arriving in Spain. I had to, like, shoot my first film, not knowing anyone, convince a bunch of strangers to, like, lend me their homes and work for free on, like, a project, on a student project. And with that film, I made the mistake of having, like, way too many locations, and realizing that's a really bad idea for a short film. Like, that's not, like, it should be about something concise that you can relate to, and you don't want to have too many characters, too many locations. Like, that's great for a feature, but for a short, that. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go the absolute opposite extreme. I want to do something just in one location. And then I was like, oh, Tatiana's script, one location. So then I came back to her and I was like, I have a totally new pitch for you. Like, it's all going to just take place in one room. And she's like, okay, great. You know? Like, at the time, we actually, like, wanted to, like, build this whole set, though. It was going to be, like, a really cool set. And then that didn't pan out. So we had to, like, scramble and find a location last minute. But I think the nice thing was that with the script, like, you know, having known the script for so long and then also not being the writer, but I was able to cast the actors quite early on and then, like, you know, have rehearsals with them and work on it. And then Tatiana would join the rehearsals through Zoom. And then, so she would, like, you know, see what was working or not, and then make little adjustments to the script based on our rehearsals. And I could just focus on, like, working with the actors and really, like, kind of getting them very comfortable with the material so that they could play with it and really be free in it. She was like, her job was, like, staying on top of the script and continuing to make it the best script possible. As you know, sometimes when you take a script and you make it into a film, it kind of takes on its own whole new life as real people step into those roles. And it's hard when you're the director, but you're also the writer and you're, like, trying to reflect those changes into the script in real time. And so we worked very well in this sort of creative process of developing the story. And I think it didn't become so much about, like, what's the set or what is the location. I mean, those are important things, but it became really about, like, the interactions between these actors and, like, kind of the base of storytelling, you know, is humans on, yeah. You know?
No, absolutely. I mean, and that's what carries through the screen is that those characters no spoiler, right? But I don't know if we care about spoilers, but you know, it's set in the future, a near future and or secret present, but of genetically modifying our children and whatnot. But it comes across as so authentic. And I think that's probably what you're talking about is your process just created so much authentic human behavior on screen that something that someone could, if it was done badly, someone might've looked at it and went, oh, that's just, you know, this is whatever, humbug. Whereas instead, just the story and these people leap off the screen as genuine people in a believable situation, which was a harder sell than one might think. I think I'm saying it's secretly a lot more challenging than one might think.
Yeah. It's interesting. Cause I think that there's, like, you know, there is a tendency sometimes in Hollywood to have, like, a very strong hero and anti-hero. And, like, I wanted to not do that in this short, you know, I wanted sort of everyone to be equal in a way that they're, everyone has a different perspective. So from one character's perspective, they are, well, from each character's perspective, they are their hero of their own story. And I thought that's the kind of thing that you can do in such a like constraint, such a small environment, you know, where you're, and in a short film, you know, you can experiment with like seeing a story from another character's perspective and switching that perspective. And I definitely think that my background with a theater company in Japan, where it was like very much more slice of life and you're kind of peering in on these people's conversations, very different to like sort of the maybe more traditional dramatic tradition that we get in Western theater, where you have sort of like a hero and someone, a villain, and they go through all these like suffering and something bad happens. But here it's just like, you know, they're just people. And each person thinks they're the protagonist of their own story, right? So,
each person's perspective and point of view is respected by both director and writer, which is like you said, it's not how Hollywood does it. Hollywood would have looked at the script and said right away, okay, this is what has to change.
And I mean, there were things like, for example, I think in an earlier version of the script, there was when I first acted it, like the mother was crying quite a lot. And I was like, let's maybe like pull back on the crying. And then, you know, let's see how we can use it. Like, is she crying because she's genuinely upset, or is she being manipulative? Like, let's kind of play with this ambiguity of like, how is crying used by this character? And let's make it more into negotiation between all of these different characters, rather than a tragedy where like, you know, oh, the mother is suffering, she's crying, we should identify with her. And so I think also like sometimes Hollywood wants to like treat people like they're a little bit too stupid and you need to make the story very easily understandable to them. Like, okay, there's this character crying and this one's yelling. And like, you kind of, it's very like, you know, violence and things that where you can clearly see who's right or wrong. And I think I tend to like to sort of pull back a little bit on that, like over the top emotion and have it more sort of true to like the constant changes that occur in our everyday lives, where you're going through all these different moods and things, like all, you know, so many things going on, you know, at any given moment. Like, you know, you're having this conversation with me, but maybe you're also hungry and, you know, maybe, I don't know, like,
well, and you're trusting your audience to have a brain and be able to understand complexity.
Yep.
Which exactly. that's not a Hollywood forte at all.
Yeah. And then even like within the edit, you know, the first editor who came on board, who is American, like he was like, oh, well, so the son is the evil one. And I was like, no, I do not want to edit it to make it look like that. Like, let's change this. This is the way you're editing it. It is making it look like, it's so interesting how, you know, like editing can tell a story very clearly, where you suddenly believe it sort of puts its own value judgment on characters. And which is why I think that like a true documentary doesn't really exist in a way. Like every documentary is also like telling a story because it's edited. So that was an interesting process, that every step of the way, there was always like the immediate gut reaction of like, oh, this is going to be the bad guy. And I think like that, with the editor, with the composer, with, you know, the actors, some of the actors, like, and so it was always like pulling that back and be like, okay, let's go against the instinct or the easy way of telling this, and let's like try something different.
Absolutely. No, I mean, you'd get a kick. Well, our film festival was approached by a local high school that had a film class, and I said, oh, you know what I'd love to do? Let's take a raw footage that one of our filmmakers has for a short and give it to your editing class and let every student do their own edit. And then at the festival, we can show like five versions and show just how different an editor can tell a story. Mm. And the teacher loved it. And the kids were like, oh, we're busy with our own stuff. Isn't that a bummer? Someday I got to find an editing class so I can do that experiment, because I mean, you've already shared how Homologies could have, yeah. I mean, it could have been cut to turn that son into the monster in a horror film.
Yeah, exactly.
And it even could have been cut to make the dad the monster, and it could have been cut to make the mom the monster. Like, no, nobody is actually the shark.
Anyway. Yeah. And also with the additions too, like I saw a lot of much more melodramatic additions for the mother. And I was like, I do not like it when it's too like kind of, you know, falls too deep into drama or too deep into like, you know, I think there should always be like a little mix of drama and comedy. So I think that like, I tried to get that in Homologies. It's been gratifying to see like that audiences do catch some of the like little jokes, you know? And that's also like a testament to Tatiana's great writing that, you know, the some of those lines have such great double entendre where you can be like, oh, you know, this is a really dramatic situation, but that's kind of a funny line, you know?
there is certainly humor underneath, although it probably takes the second pass. I don't know.
Yeah.
I get in trouble like, sometimes at the film festivals because, you know, if I'm seeing it for the third time and the audience is seeing it for the first, you know, very different experience.
Yeah. I mean, I like dark comedy. So, you know, I'm always like, I love it when people laugh and get the comedy in it. You know, I don't want them to take my stuff like way too seriously. I think nothing should be taken too seriously in life. But then like, if they don't get it and they just get the drama, then that's working too, you know, at least that they're getting the heart of the story. So, but I did hear like a few little chuckles, or definitely like, you know, it doesn't matter if someone's laughing or if they're like, there are certain moments where I felt a reaction from the room. And that's like what's so gratifying about being at a film festival, is that you get to feel how a whole room of people is experiencing this film and the commonalities of their experience too. So
I would imagine that's huge for you with a performance background, both in dance and acting on stage, which is, yeah, film is such a rewarding art, but you rarely get audience reactions. You rarely get to see that human experience of your work. So yeah, film festivals and, or, you know, you always hear stories about someone like Spielberg sneaking into the back row of his movies on opening day just to hear how the audience reacts. Like you, yeah, you don't, film can be very isolating between artist and audience.
Yeah. And also, cause I think it's such a product, you know, in our contemporary society where, you know, most people are not at all aware of all the layers that go into it. You know, they just see it as like a finished product. And so I think that like when you're making it, you realize how complex it is to achieve that like very finished look where it seems like it's just, you know, like, oh, something you might see on Netflix or whatever. Like that's, so I have it, you know, how people have their like likes and dislikes in films and they're like, oh, this film sucks. Like, why did they make this movie or whatever? And I always feel like, well, they made a movie, like tremendous respect for the fact that anyone ever made a movie, having actually made a movie. It's, you know, you get to see that it is such a complex art, and especially like achieving that effortlessness, I think, is something that is underrated. You know, I think that a lot of even like Hollywood, you know, sometimes in the art sphere, artistic sphere, people are very critical of kind of more mainstream movies. But I have like tremendous respect for some mainstream movies, because just like to entertain an audience is a really hard thing. And I think that's why someone like Spielberg does want to see like, is my audience being entertained? Because that's information we take as filmmakers for the next film. Like, oh, okay, I was hoping that they would react to this moment, but they're not, or this moment is landing great. You know, it's all like a learning process when you're a filmmaker. You're always wanting to make your next film be even better.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're on stage, you get instantaneous feedback, and in film, you rarely do. Well, so was this, I have a funny question. Was this one of your first times directing in English? Like in Japan, because you directed in Japan. So I assume you were directing in Japanese.
Exactly.
And then there were three films in Spain, but I only know about one. So I imagine, were any of those in Spanish?
Yeah, the first one was part in Spanish, part in Catalan, part in English. And then the last one that's coming out very soon, actually, I'm going to be sending it to film festivals very soon. It's with two kids. Actually, the boy from Homologies is one of the stars in it. And it's very little dialogue. So it's all visuals and dance and music and it's kind of the opposite of Homologies. Like I did the contained space, all dialogue, and then I did the lots of different beautiful visuals of Barcelona and almost no dialogue, but just telling the story through the physical performance of the actors and dance as well.
I should just wait till we're not recording, but I'll throw in a plug for you, which is, or for my friend's film. I'm a guest curator every year for a dance film festival in the UK.
Cool. Oh, wow.
EDIFF, Exeter Dance International Film Festival. And,
great.
And the head programmer is a wonderful person. She's just, I think she, you know, what can I say? I love dance films. So anyway.
Great. That's fantastic to know.
And so clearly you've caught the bug, and making films has not, some people make a couple and then they're like, okay, I don't. So you're in it.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I'm just kind of like finishing touches on that one short. I have another little short too that I'm finishing off. And then, the main step for me now is like trying to get my features made. So I have, at this point, like three completed feature scripts that I'm sort of starting to shop around, look for producers, look for people to get on board. I might make a proof of concept for one of them. So that would be my exception to my idea of like not doing shorts anymore. It would be to make a short film that like parlays into a feature. I do also very much want to direct episodic because I enjoy that experience with Tatiana so much of like directing someone else's script and just focusing on the job of the director. And I think that's the big difference between working in television versus working in the feature space, or especially the independent feature space, is that you know, when you're doing an independent feature, you might be the screenwriter, or you might be a producer, the director, all of these different things. But in the episodic world, you're just focusing on your job as a director. It's kind of more like divided amongst the different crafts, I think.
For sure, for sure. And I guess my last question is acting solely in your rear view now?
No, absolutely not. I recently signed with an agent here in LA, which is exciting. ASAP Talent Agency, and they just gave me my first audition not too long ago, so that was fun. I definitely like always when I'm not acting for too long, I really miss it. I think that it's a very necessary emotional and creative outlet for me. I'm not adverse 100% to acting in my own projects. My preference is though to work as an actress, work with other directors, and then like as a director to work with other actors. Because it's fun also as an, like now that I am also a director, to like go back and be on someone else's set as an actress and sort of observe how they do it. It's really fun.
And is the door to acting in Japan still open, or has it been too many years?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I think that, it's kind of something I've had to learn is that it's surprisingly hard to have a career actually across multiple different continents. I thought that it was something like, oh, everything is partially online. Like you can just like be there, but you have to kind of like, you actually have to be there. And
you need
and
some FaceTime with people, and
exactly,
you need to
yeah,
be on their mind, yeah. And yeah. I guess that during lockdown, there was a moment where this Zoom stuff was all we had, and borders became meaningless. But yeah, they're back. I guess the borders have returned.
Yeah, I think that it definitely, I mean, what it was interesting to me coming from Japan to Los Angeles, how, like, you know, having starred in features in Japan and being repped by like one of the top agencies, and, you know, that to like see that just coming to a different market, how much of a nobody I was, that didn't parlay. And then, you know, even like, you know, even within like, say, France, like, you know, I had my film I started and was like, you know, released theatrically in France, very positively reviewed. But then, like, I'm not part of that inner circle of people who know each other. And so, and then this is also in the film industry, like, people have a very short memory where it's like, you kind of have to always like be the, like, part of like the it group, you know, in a way. It's it's been a lesson for me that, like, cause I thought, oh, I have all these language skills, you know, I have all this experience. Like, of course I should be auditioning to be like, you know, starring in a TV show that needs French speakers or Japanese speakers or, you know, like, but then like, oh no, cause I haven't worked up my way up through this particular system or gotten to know these particular people. I'm not going to be invited to that audition, you know, cause there's all these people who've been hanging out around here for the past 10 years waiting for their big break, and they're ahead of me in line. And so that's something I think that people who are new to Hollywood, they always have to kind of, I mean, some people get very lucky, as I think I got very lucky in Japan where I got a break right away. That does occasionally happen where someone just gets a lucky break right away. But for the most part, I think it's kind of like you realize that you're trying to become part of a community of people, and other people are ahead of you in line, and you have to kind of like wait your turn in some senses.
And I'll throw one last barb at Hollywood and add that odds are no one in Hollywood respects the films in Japan and France as much as they should. Like, the fact that you've been the lead in Japan and the lead in France, they should go, oh, that means something. But I have a hunch they don't, their egos won't let them respect the work outside of this country as much as they should.
But that's something really interesting. That's like, I definitely felt that when I came here. But I think that that's also something that is changing now, with just like the success of Netflix and,
that's, you know, true. Netflix is actually slapping them around as well. And I guess COVID sped that up because Netflix could the strike sped it up because Netflix could produce things overseas. And Netflix Netflix is showing Hollywood, no, stuff made in Korea can be the most popular thing in the world right now.
Exactly.
Something made, yeah. And like, they brought us shows from Germany.
Yep. So I think that that's really like, it is a wake up call, and it's exciting that I think it is, people are going to have to become more open and interested in international content. Because I think the survival of Hollywood depends on it.
Their survival does. So the question is, will they adapt and survive? Mm-hmm. Well, they'll figure something out. All right. Well, excellent. Well, do you want to, I didn't warn you, but is there a website or social media that people should follow for you? Or?
Yeah. So I'll spell out my name, though it's probably in the title. It's BRYERLY. My last name is Long, LNG. So I have a website, BriarlyLong.com. And then I'm also on Instagram and Facebook. And I'd love to connect with people. As
we
my
will, we will make
out.
Those will be clickable links in the, in the show notes. A big thank you to Calvin, who's my podcast producer. I got a producer now. So thanks, Calvin. Calvin actually is going to handle those clickable links, although I'll give him the links. And of course, there's always, and if people want to know more about Homologies, it's homologiesshortfilm.com.
Exactly.
Which is a tough one to spell, but that's okay. It'll be a clickable show note. And I will get us out of here with my closing spiel, as I call it, which is, first I'm going to thank Briarly for hopping on Zoom and talking to me for a while. Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for listening. If you want to learn more about this podcast, the Discover Indie Film podcast, or the TV series that was born from it, just go to discoverindiefilm.com, and it's at DIF Wins on social media. I mentioned the TV series. It's on Amazon Prime Video. So just go to Amazon Prime Video, and when you search for Discover indie film. Somewhere it's Discover India, and then you add that E for indie, and then I think we're first. So what do you know? Discover India. I should watch Discover India someday so I can comment on it. Since
thank you
since
so
I see
much.
It all the time when I search for my own show, I produce it. And we mentioned the Sherman Oaks Film Festival where Brierley won her first award.
Yes, woo-hoo! Thank you
we
very
hold
much.
The Sherman Oaks Film Festival every November. You can learn more at ShermanOaksFF.com, and it's at ShermanOaksFF on social media. It has a sister festival every June called Film Invasion Los Angeles. That one is filminvasionla.com and at filminvasionla on social media. And the last thing of the spiel is that because I have no respect for my personal time, I started a thing called TV High. If you go to watchtvhigh.com or at watchtvhigh on all the platforms, it's a streaming service. It's a smart TV app that has really wonderful indie films, some stand-up comedy, all kinds of great stuff to watch. And
I just checked out TV High. I was curious, and I saw, I think, one of the best titles I've seen in a while. It was The Penis Between Us.
The Penis Between Us. I'm glad you checked it out. I will share that. I have to tell
hilarious.
You about it now, because it doesn't take long. Magical realism.
Uh-huh.
Three dudes living in an apartment in the San Fernando Valley, which for those who aren't in LA is just like standard suburb of LA. And for some reason we don't understand, they share a penis. So like, and it's shot like The Office with confessionals to camera. So like someone's like, Johnny took the penis away for the weekend. I'm dying. I got a date in 10 minutes and I need it back. Blah, blah, blah. It's just a hilarious, magical world where men have to share their manhood. I'm not even sure what the analogy metaphor gets me to, but it's also really funny.
Yeah, the title had me and my fiance just like cracked up for a few minutes. We're like, what is this movie? Yeah.
It's so funny. Hopefully, you know, knock on wood, TV High becomes a smashing success and I can turn to them and go, guess what? We're going to fund a second season. But anyway.
We weren't high, by the way, when we saw that. But.
You don't have to be high. I didn't. It's funny. I sometimes don't always mention it. The idea behind TV High, Watch TV High, is that cannabis is legal in Los Angeles, in California. So I do enjoy it. I enjoy it. I'll just, at the end of the day, I'm actually not awake and baked, not to judge anybody, but at night, sometimes I would be stoned and can't find a gosh darn thing on streaming services that I wanted to watch. And I thought, okay, let's see if we can put together a bunch of wonderful indie content for people to watch when they're high. But the truth is, you do not have to be high to enjoy the stuff. It's all so good. And I have had people say to me, isn't everything better high? And I'm like, I'm not sure about horror, but everything, sure. Everything else.
Yeah.
All right, Brierley, thank you so much.
Thank you. I hope we meet again soon at one of your film festivals.
Yes, I hope to see a lot more of your work. And we're going to stop and then we'll record your answers to those four questions.
Okay, great.
All right, cool. I don't know if I prepped you for that. All right. Thank you, everybody. And like and subscribe to the podcast if you can. All right. Bye.